Side 2. Chapter 3. Hot Ice. James Bond shut the door of M's office behind him. He smiled into the warm brown eyes of Miss Moneypenny and walked across her office into the Chief of Staff's room. The Chief of Staff, a lean, relaxed man of about Bond's age, put down his pen and sat back in his chair. He watched as Bond automatically reached for the flat gunmetal cigarette case in his hip pocket and walked over to the open window and looked down onto Regent's Park. There was a thoughtful deliberation in Bond's movements that answered the Chief of Staff's question. "So, you've bought it." Bond turned round. "Yes," he said. He lit a cigarette. Through the smoke, his eyes looked very directly at the Chief of Staff. "But tell me this, Bill. Why's the old man got cold feet about this job? He's even looked up the results of my last medical. What's he so worried about? It's not as if this was Iron Curtain business. America's a civilized country, more or less. What's eating him?" It was the Chief of Staff's duty to know most of what went on in M's mind. His own cigarette had gone out, and he lit it and threw the spent match over his left shoulder. He looked round to see whether it had fallen in the waste paper basket. It had. He smiled up at Bond. "Constant practice," he said. Then, "There aren't many things that worry M, James, and you know that as well as anybody in the service. Smersh, of course, the German cipher breakers, the Chinese opium ring, or at any rate the power they have all over the world, and the authority of the Mafia, and he's got a damned healthy respect for them, the American gangs, the big ones. That's all. Those are the only people that get him worried. And this diamond business looks as if it's pretty certain to bring you up against the gangs. They're the last people he expected us to get mixed up with. He's got quite enough in his plate without them. That's all. That's what's giving him cold feet about this job."
"There's nothing so extraordinary about American gangsters," protested Bond. "They're not Americans. Mostly a lot of Italian bums with monogrammed shirts who spend the day eating spaghetti and meatballs and squirting scent over themselves."
"That's what you think," said the Chief of Staff. "But the point is that those are only the ones you see. There are better ones behind them, and still better ones behind those. Look at narcotics. 10 million addicts. Where do they get the stuff from? And look at gambling, legitimate gambling. $250 million a year is the take at Las Vegas. Then there are the undercover games at Miami and Chicago and so on, all owned by the gangs and their friends. A few years ago, Bugsy Siegel got the back of his head blown off because he wanted too much of the take from the Las Vegas operation, and he was tough enough. These are big operations. Do you realize gambling's the biggest single industry in America? Bigger than steel, bigger than motor cars, and they take damn good care to keep it running smoothly. Get hold of a copy of the Kofova report, if you don't believe me. And now these diamonds, $6 million a year is good money, and you can bet your life it'll be well protected." The Chief of Staff paused. He looked impatiently up at the tall figure in the dark blue single-breasted suit and into the obstinate eyes and the lean brown face. "Perhaps you haven't read the FBI report on American crime for this year. Interesting. Just 34 murders every day. Nearly 150,000 Americans criminally killed in the last 20 years. Bond looked incredulous. "It's a fact, damn you. Get hold of these reports and see for yourself. And that's why M wanted to make sure you are fit before he put you into the pipeline. You're going to take these gangs on, and you'll be by yourself. Satisfied?" Bond's face relaxed. "Come on, Bill," he said. "If that's all there is to it, I'll buy you lunch. It's my turn, and I feel like celebrating. No more paperwork this summer. I'll take you to Scott's, and we'll have some of their dressed crab and a pint of black velvet. You've taken a load off my mind. I thought there might be some ghastly snag about this job." "All right, blast you." The Chief of Staff put aside the misgivings which he fully shared with his chief and followed Bond out of the office and slammed the door with unnecessary force behind him. Later, punctually at 2 o'clock, Bond was shaking hands with the dapper, level-eyed man in the old-fashioned office which hears more secrets than any other room in Scotland Yard. Bond had made friends with Assistant Commissioner Valance over the Moonraker affair, and there was no need to waste time on preliminaries. Valance pushed a couple of CID identification photographs across the desk. They showed a dark-haired, rather good-looking young man with a clean-cut, swashbuckling face in which the eyes smiled innocently.
"That's your chap," said Valance. "Near enough like you to pass with someone who's only got his description. Peter Franks. Nice-looking fella.
Good family, public school and all that. And then he went wrong and stayed wrong. Country house burglaries are his line. May have been on the Duke of Windsor job at Sunningdale a few years ago. We've pulled him in once or twice, but we could never get anything to stick. Now he's slipped up. They often do when they get into a racket they know nothing about. I've got two or three undercover girls in Soho, and he's keen on one of them. Funnily enough, she's rather keen on him. Thinks she can make him go straight and all that sort of stuff. But she's got a job to do. And when he told her about this job, just casually, as if it were the hell of a lark, she passed the word back here. Bond nodded. The specialist crooks never take other people's lines seriously. I bet he wouldn't have talked to her about one of his country house jobs. Not in your life, agreed Valance. Or we'd have had him inside years ago. Anyway, it seems he was contacted by a friend of a friend and agreed to do a smuggling job to America for $5,000, payable on delivery. My girl asked him if it was drugs, and he laughed and said, no, better still, hot ice. Had he got the diamonds? No. His next job was to contact his guard tomorrow evening at the Trafalgar Palace, 5 o'clock in her room, a girl called Case. She would tell him what to do and go over with him. Valance got up and paced to and fro in front of the framed forgeries of £5 notes that lined the wall opposite the windows. These smugglers generally go in pairs when big stuff is being moved. The carrier is never quite trusted, and the men at the other end like to have a witness in case anything goes wrong at the customs. Then the big men don't get caught napping if the carrier talks. Big stuff being moved, carriers, customs, guards. Bond killed his cigarette in the ashtray on Valance's desk. How often in his early days in his own service had he been part of this same routine? Through Strasbourg into Germany, through Nyegoryeloye into Russia, over the Simplon, across the Pyrenees, the tension, the dry mouth, the nails ground into the palms of the hands. And now, having graduated away from all that, here he was going through with it again. Yes, I see, said Bond, dodging his memories. But what's the general picture? Got any ideas? What sort of an operation was Franks going to fit into? Well, the diamonds certainly come from Africa. Valance's eyes were opaque. Probably not the Union mines. More likely the big leak out of Sierra Leone our friend Sillitoe's been looking for. Then the stones may get out through Liberia, or more likely French Guinea. Then perhaps into France. And since this packet's turned up in London, presumably London's part of the pipeline too. Valance stopped his pacing and faced Bond. And now we know that this packet is on its way to America. And what happens to it there is anybody's guess. The operators wouldn't try and save money on the cutting, and that's where half the price of a diamond goes. So it looks as if the stones get funneled into some legitimate diamond business and then get cut and marketed like any other stones. Valance paused. You wouldn't mind if I give you a bit of advice? Don't be ridiculous. Well, said Valance, in all these jobs, the payoff to subordinates is generally the weakest link. How is this $5,000 to be paid to Peter Franks? Who by? And if he did the job successfully, would he be taken on again? If I was in your shoes, I'd watch these points. Concentrate on getting through the cutout who does the paying off and try to get on further up the pipeline towards the big men. If they like the look of you, it shouldn't be difficult. Good carriers aren't easy to come by, and even the top men are going to be interested in the new recruit. Yes, said Bond thoughtfully. That makes sense. The main trouble will be to get past the first contact in America. Let's hope the whole job doesn't blow up in my face in the custom shed at Idlewild. I shall look pretty silly if the inspector scope picks me up. But I expect this case woman will have some bright ideas about actually carrying the stuff. And now, what's the first step? How are we going to substitute me for Peter Franks? Valance started pacing to and fro again. I think that ought to be all right, he said. We're going to take in Franks this evening and hold him for conspiring to evade the customs. He smiled briefly. It'll break up a beautiful friendship with my girl, I'm afraid. But that's got to be faced. And then the idea is for you to make the rendezvous with Miss Case. Does she know anything about Franks? Just his description and his name, said Valance. At least that's what we guess. I doubt if she even knows the man who contacted him. Cutouts all along the line. Everyone does one job in a watertight compartment. Then, if there's a hole in the sock, it doesn't run. Know anything about the woman? Passport details. American citizen. 27. Born San Francisco. Blonde. Blue eyes. Height 5 foot 6 inches. Profession. Single woman. Been over here a dozen times in the last 3 years. May have been more often under a different name. Always stays at the Trafalgar Palace. The hotel detective says she doesn't seem to go out much. Few visitors. Never stays more than 2 weeks. Never gives any trouble. That's all. Don't forget that when you meet her, you'll have to have a good story yourself. Why you're doing the job and so on. I'll see to that. Anything else we can help over? Bond reflected. The rest seemed to be up to him. Once he had got into the pipe, it would just be a question of improvising. Then he remembered the jewellery firm. What about this House of Diamonds lead the Treasury dreamed up? Seems a long shot. Any views?
Quite honestly, I hadn't bothered with them.
There was apology in Valance's voice. I checked on this man's say, but again it's a blank, except for his passport details. American, 45, diamond merchant, and so on. He goes to Paris a lot, been going once a month for the last 3 years, as a matter of fact. Probably got a girl there. Tell you what, why not go along and have a look at the place, and at him? You never can tell. How would I set about that? Asked Bond dubiously. Valance didn't answer. Instead, he pressed a switch on the big intercom on his desk.
Yes, sir?
Said a metallic voice. Send up Dankwert to the double, please, Sergeant. And Lavinia. And then get me the House of Diamonds on the telephone. Gem Merchants in Hatton Garden. Ask for Mr. Say. Valance went and looked out of the window at the river. He took a cigarette lighter out of his waistcoat pocket and flicked at it absent-mindedly. There was a knock on the door, and Valance's staff secretary put his head in. Sergeant Dankwert, sir. Send him in, said Valance. Hold Lavinia until I ring. The secretary held open the door, and a nondescript man in plain clothes came in. His hair was thinning, he wore spectacles, and his complexion was pale. His expression was kindly and studious. He might have been any senior clerk in any business.
"Afternoon, Sergeant," said Valance. "This is Commander Bond of the Ministry of Defence."
The sergeant smiled politely.
"I want you to take Commander Bond to the House of Diamonds in Hatton Garden. He will be Sergeant James of your staff. You think the diamonds from that Ascot job are on their way out to the Argentine through America. You will say so to Mr. Say, the top man there. You will wonder if it's possible that Mr. Say has heard any talk from the other side. His New York office may have heard something, you know, all very nice and polite. But just look him in the eye. Put as much pressure on him as you can without giving any grounds for complaint. Then apologize and leave and forget all about it. All right? Any questions?
No, sir.
Said Sergeant Dankwood stolidly. Valance spoke into the intercom, and a moment later there appeared a sallow, rather ingratiating man wearing extremely smart plain clothes and carrying a small attaché case. He stood waiting just inside the door.
Good afternoon, Sergeant. Come have a look at this friend of mine.
The sergeant came and stood close up to Bond and politely turned him towards the light. Two very keen, dark eyes examined his face minutely for a full minute. Then the man stepped away.
"Can't guarantee the scar for more than 6 hours, sir," he said. "Not in this heat, but the rest's all right. Who is he to be, sir?"
"He's to be Sergeant James, a member of Sergeant Dankwert's staff."
Valance looked at his watch. "Only for 3 hours, all right?"
"Certainly, sir. Shall I go ahead?"
At Valance's nod, the policeman led Bond to a chair by the window, put his small attaché case on the floor beside the chair, and knelt down on one knee and opened it. Then, for 10 minutes, his light fingers busied themselves over Bond's face and hair. Bond resigned himself and listened to Valance talking to the House of Diamonds.
"Not until 3:30. In that case, would you please tell Mr. Say that two of my men will be calling on him at 3:30 sharp?
Yes, I'm afraid it is rather important. Only formality, of course. Routine inquiry. I don't expect it will take up more than 10 minutes of Mr. Say's time. Thank you so much. Yes, Assistant Commissioner Valance."
"That's right.
Scotland Yard, yes.
Thank you. Goodbye."
Valance put back the receiver and turned towards Bond.
"The secretary says Say won't be back until 3:30. I suggest you get there at 3:15. Never does any harm to have a look round first. Always useful to get your man a bit off balance. How's it going?"
Sergeant Lavinier held up a pocket mirror in front of Bond. A touch of white at the temples, the scar gone, a hint of studiousness at the corners of the eyes and mouth, the faintest shadows under the cheekbones, and nothing you could put your finger on. But it all added up to someone who certainly wasn't James Bond.
Chapter 4. What goes on around here?
In the patrol car, Sergeant Dankwurz was occupied with his thoughts, and they drove in silence along the Strand and up Chancery Lane and into Holborn. At Gamage's, they turned left into Hatton Garden, and the car drew up near the neat white portals of the London Diamond Club. Bond followed his companion across the pavement to a smart door, in the centre of which was a well-polished brass plate on which was engraved "The House of Diamonds," and underneath, "Rufus B. Say, Vice President for Europe." Sergeant Dankwurz rang the bell, and a smart Jewish girl opened the door and led them across a thickly carpeted entrance hall into a panelled waiting room. "I'm expecting Mr. Say any minute now," she said indifferently, and went out and closed the door. The waiting room was luxurious, and thanks to an unseasonable log fire in the Adam fireplace, tropically hot. In the centre of the close-fitted dark red carpet, there was a circular Sheraton rosewood table and six matching armchairs that Bond guessed were worth at least £1,000. On the table were the latest magazines and several copies of the Kimberley Diamond News. Dankwurz's eyes lit up when he saw these, and he sat down and started to turn over the pages of the June issue. On each of the four walls was a large flower painting in a golden frame. Something almost three-dimensional about these paintings caught Bond's attention, and he walked over to examine one of them. It was not a painting, but a stylized arrangement of freshly cut flowers set behind glass in niches lined with copper-coloured velvet. The others were the same, and the four Waterford vases in which the flowers stood were a perfect set. The room was very quiet, except for the hypnotic tick of a large sunburst wall clock, and the soft murmur of voices from behind a door opposite the entrance. There was a click, and the door opened a few inches, and a voice with a thick foreign intonation expostulated volubly, "But Mr. Grunspan, why being so hard? We must all make a living, yes? I am telling you, this wonderful stone cost me £10,000. 10,000! You don't believe me, but I swear it on my word of honour." There was a negative pause, and the voice made its final bid. "Better still, I bet you £5. There was the sound of laughter. "Philly, you're a real card," said an American voice. "But it's no dice. Be glad to help you, but that stone isn't worth more than 9,000. And I'll give you 100 on top of that for yourself. Now you go along and think about it. You won't get a better offer in the street." The door opened, and a stage American businessman with pince-nez and a tightly buttoned mouth ushered out a small, harassed-looking Jew with a large red rose in his buttonhole. They looked startled at finding the waiting room occupied, and with a muttered, "Pardon me," to no one in particular, the American almost ran his companion across the room and out into the hall. The door closed behind them. Dankwurz looked up at Bond and winked. "That's the whole of the diamond business in a nutshell," he said. "And that was Willie Burns, one of the best-known freelance brokers in the street. I suppose the other man was Say's buyer." He turned again to his paper, and Bond, resisting the impulse to light a cigarette, went back to his examination of the flower pictures. Suddenly the rich, carpeted, ticking silence of the room struck like a cuckoo clock. Simultaneously a log fell in the grate, the sunburst clock on the wall chimed the half hour, the door was thrust open, and a big, dark man took two quick steps in the room and stood looking sharply from one to the other. "My name is Say," he said harshly. "What goes on around here? What do you want?" The door was open behind him. Sergeant Dankwurz rose to his feet and walked politely but firmly round the man and closed it. Then he returned to the middle of the room. "I am Sergeant Dankwurz of the Special Branch of Scotland Yard," he said in a quiet, peaceful voice. "And this," he made a gesture towards Bond, "is Sergeant James. It occurred to the Assistant Commissioner," the voice was of velvet, "that you might be able to help us."
"Yes," said Mr. Say. He looked contemptuously from one to the other of these two underpaid flat feet who had the effrontery to be taking up his time. "Go ahead."
While Sergeant Dankwurz, in tones which to a lawbreaker would have sounded menacingly level, and consulting from time to time a small black notebook, recited a story studded with "on the 16th instance," and "it came to our knowledge," Bond made an unconcealed examination of Mr. Say, which appeared to perturb Mr. Say no more than the undertones of Sergeant Dankwurz's recitation. Mr. Say was a large, compact man, with the hardness of a chunk of quartz.
He had a very square face, whose sharp angles were accentuated by short, wiry, black hair, cut en brosse and without side whiskers. His eyebrows were black and straight, and tucked in below them there were two extremely sharp and steady black eyes. He was clean-shaven, and his lips were a thin and rather wide, straight line. The square chin was deeply cleft, and the muscles bulged at the points of the jaw. He was dressed in a roomy, black, single-breasted suit, a white shirt, and an almost bootlace thin black tie, held in place by a gold tie-clip representing a spear. His long arms hung relaxed at his sides and terminated in two very large hands, now slightly curled inwards, whose backs showed black hair. His big feet, in expensive black shoes, looked to be about size 12. Bond summed him up as a tough and capable man who had triumphed in a variety of hard schools, and who looked as if he was still serving in one of them. "And these are the stones we are particularly interested in," concluded Sergeant Dankwartz. He referred to his black book. "One 20-carat Wesselton, two fine blue whites of about 10 carats each, one 30-carat yellow Premier, one 15-carat top Cape, and two 15-carat Cape Unions." He paused. Then he looked up from his book and very sharply into Mr. Say's hard black eyes. "Have any of those passed through your hands, Mr. Say? Or through your firm in New York?" he inquired softly.
"No," said Mr. Say flatly. "They have not." He turned to the door behind him and opened it. "And now, good afternoon, gentlemen." Without bothering any further with them, he walked decisively out of the room, and they heard his footsteps go rapidly up a few stairs. A door opened and banged shut, and there was silence. Undismayed, Sergeant Dankwart slipped his notebook into his waistcoat pocket, picked up his hat, and walked out into the hall and then out into the street. Bond followed him. They climbed into the patrol car, and Bond gave the address of his flat off the King's Road. When the car was moving, Sergeant Dankwart relaxed his official face. He turned to Bond. He looked amused. "I quite enjoyed that," he said cheerfully. "Don't often meet a nut as tough as that one. Did you get what you wanted, sir?"
Bond shrugged his shoulders. "Tell the truth, Sergeant, I didn't know exactly what I did want. But I was glad to get a good look at Mr. Rufus B. Say. Quite a chap. Doesn't look much like my idea of a diamond merchant."
Sergeant Dankwart chuckled.
"He's not a diamond merchant, sir," he said, "or I'll eat my hat."
"How do you know?"
"When I read out that list of missing stones," Sergeant Dankwart smiled happily, "I mentioned a yellow Premier and two Cape Unions."
"Yes?"
"It just happens that there aren't such things, sir."
Chapter 5. Feuille Morte. Bond felt the lift man watching him as he walked down the long, quiet corridor to the end room, room 350. Bond wasn't surprised. He knew there was more petty crime in this hotel than in any other large hotel in London. Valance had once shown him the big monthly crime map of London. He had pointed to the forest of little flags round the Trafalgar Palace. "That place annoys the map room men," he had said. "Every month this corner gets so pitted with holes they have to paste fresh paper over it to hold the next month's pins." As Bond neared the end of the corridor, he could hear a piano swinging a rather sad tune. At the door of 350, he knew the music came from behind it. He recognized the tune. It was Feuille Morte. He knocked.
"Come in."
The hall porter had telephoned and the voice was waiting for him. Bond walked into the small living room and closed the door behind him.
"Lock it,"
said the voice. It came from the bedroom. Bond did as he was told and walked across the middle of the room until he was opposite the open bedroom door. As he passed the portable long player on the writing desk, the pianist began on La Ronde. She was sitting, half-naked, astride a chair in front of the dressing table, gazing across the back of the chair into the triple mirror. Her bare arms were folded along the tall back of the chair, and her chin was resting on her arms. Her spine was arched, and there was arrogance in the set of her head and shoulders.
the black string of her brassiere across the naked back, the tight black lace pants, and the splay of her legs whipped at Bond's senses. The girl raised her eyes from looking at her face and inspected him in the mirror, briefly and coolly. "I guess you're the new help," she said in a low, rather husky voice that made no commitment. "Take a seat and enjoy the music. Best light record ever made." Bond was amused. He obediently took a few steps to a deep armchair, moved it a little so that he could still see her through the doorway, and sat down. "You mind if I smoke?" he said, taking out his case and putting a cigarette in his mouth. "If that's the way you want to die." Miss Case resumed the silent contemplation of her face in the mirror while the pianist played J'attendrai. Then it was the end of the record. Indifferently, she flexed her hips back off the chair and stood up. She half turned her head, and the blonde hair that fell heavily to the base of her neck curved with the movement and caught the light. "If you like it, turn it over," she said carelessly. "Be with you in a moment." She moved out of sight. Bond walked over to the gramophone and picked up the record. It was Georges Fay with rhythm accompaniment. He looked at the number and memorized it. It was Vox 500. He examined the other side and, skipping La Vie en Rose, because it had memories for him, put the needle down at the beginning of Avril au Portugal. Before he left the gramophone, he pulled the blotter slightly from under it and held it to the standard lamp beside the writing desk. He held it sideways under the light and glanced along it. It was unmarked. He shrugged his shoulders and slipped it back under the machine and walked back to his chair. He thought that the music was appropriate to the girl. All the tunes seemed to belong to her. No wonder it was her favourite record. It had her brazen sexiness, the rough tang of her manner, and the poignancy that had been in her eyes as they looked moodily back at him out of the mirror. Bond had had no picture in his mind of the Miss Case who was to shadow him to America. He had taken for granted that it would be some tough, well-used slattern with dead eyes, a hard, sullen woman who had gone the route and whose body was no longer of any interest to the gang she worked for. This girl was tough, all right, tough of manner, but whatever might be the history of her body, the skin had shone with life under the light. What was her first name? Bond got up again and walked over to the gramophone. There was a Pan American Airways label attached to the grip. It said, "Miss T. Case." T. Bond walked back to his chair. Teresa, Tess, Thelma, Trudy, Tilly. None of them seemed to fit. Surely not Trixie or Tony or Tommy. He was still playing with the problem when she appeared quietly in the doorway of the bedroom and stood with one elbow resting high up against the door jamb and her head bent sideways onto her hand. She looked down at him reflectively. Bond got unhurriedly to his feet and looked back at her. She was dressed to go out, except for her hat, a small black affair that swung from her free hand. She wore a smart black tailor-made over a deep olive-green shirt buttoned at the neck, golden-tan nylons and black square-toed crocodile shoes that looked very expensive. There was a slim gold wristwatch and a black strap at one wrist and a heavy gold chain bracelet at the other. One large, baguette-cut diamond flared on the third finger of her right hand, and a flat pearl earring in twisted gold showed on her right ear where the heavy pale gold hair fell away from it. She was very beautiful, in a devil-may-care way, as if she kept her looks for herself and didn't mind what men thought of them, and there was an ironical tilt to the finely drawn eyebrows above the wide, level, rather scornful grey eyes that seemed to say, "Sure, come and try. But, brother, you'd better be tops." The eyes themselves had the rare quality of chatoyance. When jewels have chatoyance, the colour in the lustre changes with movement in the light, and the colour of this girl's eyes seemed to vary between a light grey and a deep grey-blue. Her skin was lightly tanned and without makeup, except for a deep red on the lips, which were full and soft and rather moody, so as to give the effect of what is called a sinful mouth. But not, thought Bond, one that often sinned, if one was to judge by the level eyes and the hint of authority and tension behind them. The eyes now looked impersonally into his. End of side 2.